Hi, everybody, and welcome to A Time for Change. I'm Alexis Christophorus here with Seville Marsalis. This month marks 30 years since attorney Anita Hill testified during the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Clarence Thomas, telling a Senate Judiciary Committee and the world that Thomas had sexually harassed her when they worked together, allegations that Thomas denied. Hill's testimony, given before 14 white male senators, lasted 3 days.
I have no personal vendetta against Clarence Thomas. I seek only to provide the committee with information which it may regard as relevant. It would have been more comfortable to remain silent. It took no initiative to inform anyone. I took no initiative to inform anyone. But when I was asked by a representative of this committee to report my experience, I felt that I had to tell the truth. I could not keep silent.
Anita Hill is now a professor of social policy, law, and women's gender and sexuality studies at Brandeis University. She's also the author of the new book, Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. We talked to her about her new book and how testifying before Congress changed the trajectory of her life.
I can't think of anything that I would do differently right now about my testimony. What I would do differently about the process is something that I've written about and I think about a lot. For example, I would have a process. I would have a process that was clear, that I knew exactly what I was going into before it happened, that I would know even before I sent in my statement where it was going to go, who was going to see it on the committee, what kind of opportunity that I would have to respond or what opportunity other people would have to testify. And what we had was a process that was far less than clear, seemed to be evolving the whole time, and that excluded witnesses. And so that would be my correction.
After the hearings, Clarence Thomas was confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. How did that impact your life and career pursuits?
You know, I'm not sure that his confirmation actually changed my career. I think what happened was the public responded to a system or a process in terms of the hearing that vehemently vilified me. And I think that was the source of any changes that came about. But basically, I ended up leaving my job at the University of Oklahoma. The job was threatened before I left. It was clear that there was a great deal of hostility against me coming from state legislators. It wasn't universal, but it was enough to change the culture and environment that I worked in. And I ultimately left, though, because I wanted to do more with the issue of sexual harassment and other forms of gender discrimination and violence.
Anita, you were a woman, a Black woman, recounting sexual harassment. Was the country ready to hear your story and to believe you at the time?
Well, certainly not the entire country was. After my testimony, it was clear a majority of individuals from all categories who said that they didn't believe that my story was truthful or that the story didn't make sense. However, you know, I've heard from individuals who have said they understood very clearly what was going on. And very recently, I heard from young women, women who are a few years younger than I am, who said that when they heard my testimony, they understood their own experiences. These were women who were just sort of coming of age, coming into their bodies as women, had been teased or harassed on the street, didn't have language for it, didn't have any understanding about why it was happening. And once they heard the testimony, they in fact understood exactly what was going on with them and knew better how to respond to it and not to internalize it. I've also heard the same from people who were suffering from sexual harassment and other forms of abuse. So some people heard and some people didn't.
Mm-hmm. You know, Anita, Clarence Thomas used that now infamous term, high-tech lynching, following your testimony back in 1991. And in many ways, that language not only turned him into a victim, but it also sort of stopped a lot of the open conversation around sexual harassment. Do you think his choice of language actually impacted progress for women at the time?
I think it was used to provide cover for his own bad behavior. I think it was a misplaced metaphor because he was not only claiming his victimhood, he was claiming his victimhood as a victim of racism. To have that launched in the context in which it did was really insincere. And not only did it provide a cover for him, it went on to provide a cover for others who would use the same metaphor, the same, and did, in fact, I think, stifle the conversation at that moment. But then almost immediately after, a group of women, African-American women, in defense of ourselves is what they call themselves, they helped clarify the fact that in the history of lynching, no man of any race had been lynched on the basis of the word of a Black woman. So the lynching metaphor was his cover, but it was also used as a weapon to exclude me from the experiences of African-American women historically, and that continue on today. If you look at the R. Kelly trial, it took 30 years nearly to get his victims to be heard, all of whom were Black women and who were dismissed for 30 years. And then ultimately, there was some gender justice found for those victims. So it's been a long time coming, but I think we're starting to understand that those kinds of excuses do not represent our best interests.
And let's talk about the role of President Biden during those hearings. So at the time, he was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee during the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Now, he has since called you to apologize for what you went through. But now that Biden is president, is there more that he should be doing on the issue of sexual harassment?
Well, and this is absolutely the reason that I am here today and the reason that I wrote the book, Believing. We are 30 years out of 1991, and yes, there were mistakes made. But the problem today of gender violence of all forms, and I talk about them in the book, whether it's sexual harassment or intimate partner violence or bullying in schools, the problem is that it still exists. It continues. We set a bad precedent in the 1991 hearings, but that doesn't alleviate anyone from the responsibility from doing something about what is going on in our workplaces, in our schools, in our universities, and on the streets, and in our homes today. I think the president has not only the ability to change course with this problem and commit to addressing it, I think he has the responsibility to do so.
In 2018, nearly 30 years after your testimony, we had the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh. Now, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford testified that while she was in high school, she was sexually assaulted by Kavanaugh, allegations he denies. Now, watching those hearings, what was going through your mind? Have you seen any progress in the past 30 years since you were the one sitting in that chair?
We absolutely have seen progress. The public has seen progress. The reaction after Christine Blasey Ford's testimony was strikingly different than the reaction after my testimony 30 years ago. And I think more was at stake than just the two differences in the two witnesses or the two behaviors that we were describing. What happened over those 30 years, or nearly 28 years, I guess, between the Kavanaugh and the Thomas hearing, what happened was that the public became much more aware of the problem of this large problem of gender-based violence, including sexual harassment and sexual assault, that the public understood it better and has accepted a willingness to hold those people who are engaging in bad behavior, hold them accountable for it. And they saw in 2018 and after Christine Blasey Ford's very brave and very convincing testimony that in fact there was a need to hold someone accountable, but they also saw that the systems weren't working, that the Senate Judiciary Committee system didn't work to help people understand what was going on, to get to the truth. The investigation that took place in 2018 was limited to her testimony and to Brett Kavanaugh's testimony, which everyone knows now who has done work in this area, that you have to do more than talk to the two principals involved. So I think where the change has occurred has been with Americans' public knowledge and understanding, awareness, and willingness to bring people, to hold them accountable, to get the full stories, and then for our public officials to act in a responsible way with that information.
I want to take you back to 1998 for a minute, because at the time you had commented on the President Bill Clinton Monica Lewinsky scandal, and you were criticized for what you said. You said, from all accounts, quote, if there was a sexual relationship, it appears that it was a consensual one. Do you still believe what you said back there in 1998?
I believe that what I said was that it appears that the two parties involved were in a consensual relationship. But even with that, even if you assume that it was coerced in some way, there was a clear power differential in that relationship. And I made very clear when I made that statement that in that situation where there is this power differential, that we have to take into account that it still could be an inappropriate relationship. And I actually even put it in this term, you know, when, even if you assume that the two of them are having a relationship that is consensual, the message that's sent throughout an organization, throughout an office, particularly to other young women and other interns, is that the way to get ahead in the workplace is to sleep with your boss, or have sex with your boss, or concede to having and a relationship that you may not want to have with your boss. And that was, to me, as big a problem as having a coercive relationship, which we often see in our workplaces. Mm-hmm. So I do stand by my comment, but I would also appreciate in reciting my comment the full context of, because I did not excuse Bill Clinton's behavior with Monica Lewinsky. And I talk about it actually in the book, Believing.
And I want to ask you about that title, Believing. Why that title? What does it mean to you? What do you hope it's going to mean to your readers?
Well, first of all, it is drawn from hearing thousands, literally thousands of survivors and victims, and believing that they deserve better from our leaders, from our institutions, from friends and colleagues who often dismiss charges out of hand without even a fair chance at a hearing, or they deny them altogether, or they deny the harm that is caused. We are just now beginning to understand this. And I know that much of your audience is a business audience. What we know for certain is that there is a huge loss, personal health loss, productivity loss in businesses, There is an economic loss because of the loss in productivity, and for all kinds of reasons. I know that businesses tend to run, you know, looking at risk and cost, but for all kinds of reasons, these issues need to be addressed by our business leaders as issues that, if addressed, can make much for much more productive and effective operations and cultures and climates within our organizations. So we aren't there yet, but we need to very much understand that the problems of sexual harassment are not going to go on their way on that away on their own. We need to understand that what we have now in many places and many organizations are systems that fail to address the problems, and that we need to take a hard look within our organizations to make sure that we are doing everything we can to keep people safe.
And Anita, speaking more about that, you wrote, quote, "Each of us has a role to play in making our world safe for everyone, and that together we can end gender violence." How do we end sexual harassment and gender violence?
Well, there are a lot of things that we need to do. The first thing we need to do, and let me just say one thing about sexual harassment and gender violence. You talk about those as though they're two distinct sets of behavior. They are not. In many cases, factually, what you have when we talk about our sexual harassment cases, what you have are behaviors such as sexual extortion. You have groping. You have sexual assault in the workplace. That is gender violence. And you also have psychological violence. It comes from the extortion very often, but also just creating an environment where people cannot do their work because the environment is so toxic and sexual. So we tend to think of sexual harassment as just words, but in the around the globe, when we think about gender violence, we are talking, the world is talking about a range of behaviors, psychological, emotional, physical, and sexual. So that's the start. First of all, understand what we're talking about, the nature of it and the extent of it and the harm of it. Secondly, we've got to acknowledge it and really challenge the systems that we now have in place. Many of them are truly set up to put all of the burden of change on victims who have been vulnerable. Many of them are so costly or so obtuse that people don't have any idea of how to navigate them. Workers don't have an idea of how to navigate them. And then when they find out, they realize that it's too costly, especially if you're a low-income worker. We set up systems that make the risk of losing jobs so high that they can't afford to complain even. And then finally, one other thing that we, and this is not the final thing, but just for today, one thing that we got to address is retaliation against people who make claims. Their rights are being violated when they do so, but that doesn't stop people within organizations for retaliating against people once they've reached out, gotten over all of the hurdles and raised complaints, gone through the proper processes in the way that they are told that they have to, then they face retaliation for doing so, for complying with the rules. And so those are just three areas. Acknowledge the problem, make their systems transparent, have full investigations, and stop the retaliation. All of this has to happen, though, at the leadership level. It has to start at the top. We know that about organizational change of all kinds. And if you're going to change your organizations, we have to have leaders on board and demanding that change.
And what about corporate America specifically? What can companies and the men and women inside them do to end sexual harassment?
Well, I think I laid out, first of all, leadership has to acknowledge it exists and that it's hurting not only the employees, but especially the employees and workers throughout their organizations, whether they're direct victims or no. But secondly, they must acknowledge that it is hurting productivity and the effectiveness that people can have in the workplace. It's costing them money. And so that's one thing that we need to start with: leadership acknowledgement of the problem and prioritizing solutions. Leaders can also bring in consultation to develop whatever the solutions are, whatever the processes are, bring in survivors and victims to help them craft solutions that will work. So often now the stories that I hear are that the solutions that come in are there to protect the people who are in power. The Hollywood Commission, which I chair, has done a survey, and this was we just closed a survey early 2020. But what we found was that people still doubt, a majority of the people, the workers in Hollywood, in the entertainment industry, the majority of them felt that there would be no accountability for bad behavior if the person who is accused and found guilty or to have committed abuse is a person with higher power and authority than the person who is the accuser. So, and this was across the board, people of all genders, people of all statuses just didn't feel that there would be accountability, and leaders have to change that message, and they have to change what is a gap in trust between the people who are working and those who are leading.
Anita Hill, attorney and professor at Brandeis University. It was so great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you.